Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, April 17th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's introduction is by Kurt Schillinger, managing editor. Not only was the United States born of revolution, historian Walter McDougall once noted, it is one. Saturday marks the 250th anniversary of the first shots fired in a revolution felt round the world. It resulted in a nation that reached the moon with a slide rule and gave rise to a global religious movement founded by a woman. It is a yet young country, still restlessly striving to perfect its founding ideal that all individuals are created equal. Let's move on to the first story. 250 years of revolution. What has the shot heard round the world wrought? The reenactment of historic battles requires a special brand of sacrifice. Those drawn into the fraternity of tricorns and coats of colonial brocade may spare no effort for authenticity, be it the stain of their buttons or the gristle in their ham. But for the men and women preparing to relive the opening choreography of the American Revolution this weekend, bringing history to life has a deeper object: to honor the stories of real people and the price they paid for freedom. By Peter Greer, Jacob Posner, Cameron Pugh, Roy Aiden Sambajon, and Melanie Stetson Freeman, reporting from Lexington and Concord, Massachusetts. His red coat glowing against the dreary day, a British officer points his sword at the Lexington militia arrayed in front of him. "Lay down your arms and disperse," he shouts. "You will not be harmed. Disperse, you damn rebels." The rebels do not disperse. They stare stonily ahead, muskets on their shoulders. "You will not drive me off my common," shouts one in reply. Dark SUVs splash by on a nearby avenue, heading for a Macchiato's or some other post-colonial suburban pursuit. This is not a real confrontation or even a movie shoot. It is a dress rehearsal for April 19th, when Lexington, Concord, and other Massachusetts towns we'll celebrate the 250th anniversary of the day-long rolling battle between redcoats and minutemen that began the Revolutionary War. Battle reenactments happen here annually. The gear is museum-worthy, muskets longer than men are tall, coats ranging from rich brocade to dun homespun. But this year's iteration of the shot heard round the world might be especially important, say local historians. That's due to the anniversary's round number and the tense, chaotic state of American politics itself. Looking backward at the whole time and place, not just the battle that exploded from it, could help put today's uncertain way forward in perspective. We've come a long way since 1775, but much of that way was rocky. The founders were not perfect, neither are we. Our history is messy and complex, says Nikki Stewart, executive director of Old North Illuminated, a nonprofit that oversees the famous Old North Church in Boston. I think the pursuit of liberty and justice for all has not yet been achieved, but, again, I think we've made great progress when I look at this sum total of 250 years. Back on Lexington Common, British troops are sweeping forward, bayonets fixed. The colonial militia members, outnumbered, shift uneasily. Their commander orders them to break formation. Then a shot rings out. Others follow. Gun smoke that smells of rotten eggs wafts over the field. When it clears, six militiamen lie on the ground. The rest of the colonials quit the field, gathering at a tree line close by. Rehearsing for a revolution. On this cool, rainy day in early April, the reenactment rehearsal has drawn a surprisingly large crowd. Several hundred onlookers surround the roped-off area, most with cell phone cameras held high. Some are surprised that the colonial militia melted away so quickly. Didn't the soon-to-be-independent Americans on this day in history send the British military, the most powerful in the world at the time, to ignominious defeat? I guess I thought the Americans weren't going to run away immediately, says Connor Barrett, a professional sailor and U.S. native who has brought his British girlfriend, Lucy Zabel, to see some historical colonial sites. In fact, the Lexington skirmish was only the battle's beginning, occurring at 5 a.m. on April 19, 1775. The British marched on to Concord in search of hidden military stores. They found a few caches and destroyed them. Meanwhile, rebels rushed to the surrounding areas by the hundreds. A much larger militia force confronted the British at Concord's Old North Bridge. An exchange of fire at 9:30 a.m., the source of Ralph Waldo Emerson's poetic shot heard round the world in Concord Hymn, sent the British reeling back down the Concord Road. The rest of the day, the British retreated toward Boston, fighting increasingly desperate battles against a militia that grew to some 4,000 combatants. To commemorate the 250th battle anniversary, this year, Lexington and Concord will hold reenactments. The National Park Service will hold what it calls tactical demonstrations at several historical sites along the Battle Road Trail, which stretches about 5 miles between the towns. A wide variety of people will participate in the reenactments, if the crowd at rehearsals is representative. They are old, young, fit, and not so. What they share is a commitment to time traveling back to the 18th century. It clears the mind. You can be an altered person. You can be somebody else, says Paul O'Shaughnessy, a Lexington native who had been a reenactor for 53 years. In his hobby life, Mr. O'Shaughnessy has risen to the ranks of top redcoats, serving as commander of His Majesty's 10th Regiment of Foot. He says he joined the British at age 15 when he started because the Minutemen reenactors were quite rude at the time. The group actively recruits and has taken on 4 or 5 new members in recent months, he says. They train and provide initial kit for rookies. A network of tailors, seamstresses, leather workers, and other specialists helps produce historically accurate equipment. Mr. O'Shaughnessy himself fixes muskets. I joke that I'm a minor arms dealer in Lexington, he says. I've got muskets, bayonets, swords, scabbards, musket carts, belts, buckles, and so much more. Reenactor groups try to maintain a steady schedule of events to keep members busy. They don't just wait for big anniversary dates. Through the spring, the 6th Middlesex Regiment of Massachusetts, for instance, has carried the colors at a hockey game, appeared at a colonial-themed fair, and taken part in local parades. The regiment often visits with student groups, typically 5th graders. That's the age children often learn about the American Revolution, says member John Greenwood. It's usually a 2-week unit for one subject, so reenactors can provide a lot of detail the classes otherwise wouldn't cover. It's not just the American Revolution. I think the teaching of history is something that is not emphasized as much today, says Mr. Greenwood. The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere and some other folks. It's true that there are a lot of things about the American Revolution in general, and the context of the battles of Lexington and Concord in particular, that Americans don't fully understand, say local historians and museum officials. Take Paul Revere. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's famous poem depicted him as a lone rider sounding the British are coming alert all the way to Concord. But he wasn't alone. A tanner named William Dawes rode a different warning route out of Boston. Neither man made it to Concord. British officers stopped him in Lincoln, questioned him, and took his horse. A third man named Samuel Prescott was the only one to complete the midnight ride. Other riders, including a teenage girl named Sybil Luddington, also warned colonists over those first few days. It's also likely that Revere never saw the lanterns hanging in the steeple of the Old North Church, the two lights that indicated the British were launching out by sea. They were meant to alert others on the far shore of the Charles River. In reality, Revere was part of a warning network that he had helped put together, says Nina Zanieri, executive director of the Paul Revere Memorial Association. As a skilled tradesman, a working man who did not attend Harvard, he was also an exemplar of the everyday people who stood up 250 years ago and mobilized against the British. He goes out the door on April 18th at 10 o'clock at night, and he's leaving behind his wife and little kids. She doesn't know if he'll be back. He doesn't know if he'll be back, says Ms. Zanieri. And that was playing out all over that evening. People were going out the door, and they didn't really know what they were getting into, and some of them didn't come home. The geographical extent of the battle may be another aspect of that April day in 1775 that many Americans do not fully grasp. Shooting was not limited to the commons in Concord and Lexington, and sniping on nearby roads. Some of the battle's most desperate encounters and many of its casualties happened after the British had left Concord, retreated through Lexington, and were struggling through a more thickly settled area to reach Boston and safety. Menotomy, today called Arlington, was the scene of bitter house-to-house encounters. The two sides, together, suffered more than 200 dead, wounded, or missing in the town, says Matthew Barras, executive director of the Arlington Historical Society. Among the casualties was Samuel Whittemore, said to be 81 years old and thought to be the oldest combatant to take part in the Revolution. He suffered bayonet and gunshot wounds while fighting behind a stone wall at the Menotomy town line, but survived, living another 17 years, long enough to see his great-great-grandchildren. Most of the actual fighting occurred in Menotomy, says Mr. Barras, the spot on which the first blood was spilt. At the Lexington Common reenactment, the British, victorious in the skirmish, reformed their lines to whistles and the beat of drums. "What are you doing?" a portly man playing a sergeant roars at a few laggards. 250 years ago, in real life, these British lines continued marching up the road to Concord. There they searched for military stores. They found flour, some musket balls, spare carriage wheels, and hidden wooden spoons, and one large cannon buried in the floor of a tavern. Today's group readies to replay the opening battle skirmish, practicing to get their rolls down for the upcoming anniversary celebration. They expect much bigger crowds than the several hundred now watching from the edges of the common. In fact, tourists of a sort have been coming here almost since the founding of the Republic, says Dan Marshall, Director of Education and Interpretation at the Lexington History Museums. President George Washington, on a grand tour of the states in 1789, stopped at Lexington to see the spot on which the first blood was spilt in the dispute with Great Britain, as he wrote in his diary. Remaining veterans of the battle reenacted it in the 1820s. But as time moved on, American memories of the battle became less vivid. Tricorn hats and dun-colored breeches became markers of a distant age. The farther we get away from an event throughout time, it's harder to look at the people involved in that event as real people, says Mr. Marshall. Primary source materials, many unearthed as part of the social history emphasis of recent decades, could help close that gap. Kim Frederick, a history teacher at Concord Academy, has been working with the Concord Museum to help put together a new Revolutionary War curriculum for 3rd, 5th, and 7th graders. Among the items it features are a letter from Eliza Stiles, a preteen girl whose Loyalist family fled Boston for Canada, the story of two Concord sisters who ran an etiquette school for young ladies during the Revolutionary period, and the trial transcript of two enslaved people from Charlestown who poisoned their captor. The curriculum also includes study of old standbys, such as a powder horn. It is neither woke history nor conservative history, Ms. Frederick says. We're trying to understand what is the Revolutionary War's legacy in terms of what does it mean to be an American in 2025? What does it mean to have a 250-year history as a republic, she says. So, what would the founders think? The founders would probably be aghast if they were dropped in today's America, says Ms. Frederick. Their idea of democracy was that only property-owning men could vote. Since then, the franchise has expanded beyond what they imagined, adding all men, women, Native Americans, Black Americans, and other formerly excluded groups. Looking back, it's easy to see the failures and hypocrisy in U.S. treatment of excluded groups. The steeple of Old North Church, where hung the lights that warned the Minutemen, was built with the proceeds of enslaved labor. But looking forward from the viewpoint of April 19, 1775, one can also see progress that the nation has made in trying to apply the ideals of the Revolution to all. This anniversary is a moment both to reflect, which is always good, but also to allow ourselves to commemorate and even celebrate the country for what it has done that's worked out well, says Ms. Zanieri of the Paul Revere Memorial Association. And the United States of America remains a young country. That's made clear talking to Mr. Barrett and Miss Zabel at Lexington Common. Reminded that the festivities are for the 250th anniversary of the beginning of the nation's independence, Mr. Barrett says, "Yeah, I don't think about that. That's pretty crazy. America is only 250 years old," says Miss Zabel, whose native country is much older. 1776, right? Says Mr. Barrett. That's nuts, Ms. Zabel says. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. The next story is from a section called The Explainer. Italy's Meloni talks tariffs with Trump. How much can she do for the EU? Europe will need to negotiate tariffs with President Donald Trump. But is the best way to do that through one-on-one talks or by bargaining as a bloc? By Colette Davidson, Paris. On Thursday, Italy's Giorgia Meloni became the first European leader to travel to Washington to meet with President Donald Trump since he introduced and then paused 20% tariffs on the European Union in April. The trip, combined with an expected meeting between Ms. Meloni and Vice President J.D. Vance in Rome on Friday, is raising debate in Europe. Some European leaders say Ms. Meloni's outreach, coming after months of trade war rhetoric between the United States and the EU, threatens to undermine the bloc's unity. Some also worry that Ms. Meloni could negotiate better terms for Italy than for the rest of the EU. But Ms. Meloni could be Europe's best chance for negotiations with the U.S., as the first round of EU-U.S. talks about Mr. Trump's tariffs stalled this week. Mr. Trump has called the right-wing prime minister a fantastic leader, and the pair share a similar conservative ideological vision on issues such as immigration and woke ideology. Why would individual EU leaders talk with the U.S.? That depends on whom you ask. If individual members have the EU's best interests in mind, bilateral talks could act as a bridge between the Trump administration and the EU at a time when the transatlantic relationship is more fragile than ever. In the case of Ms. Meloni, her special relationship with Mr. Trump could help push him closer to the zero-for-zero tariffs deal put forth by the EU in early April. The first round of EU-US trade talks this week were unfruitful, with trade negotiators complaining they did not get clarity on Mr. Trump's demands. Individual meetings between Mr. Trump and his closest EU allies, in this case Ms. Meloni, could help unlock the clues about Mr. Trump's recent chaotic trade proposals. There are many motives that have been floated. Sometimes it's about revenue, sometimes it's reindustrialization and jobs, or China, said Arantxa Gonzalez, the dean of the Paris School of International Affairs at Sciences Po, and Spain's former Minister of Foreign Affairs, during a meeting Wednesday with journalists. We don't know which of these contradictory objectives weigh more heavily. Still, there are skeptics about the bilateral talks. Last week, Marc Ferracci, France's Minister for Industry and Energy, warned that the Meloni-Trump meeting would play into Mr. Trump's strategy to divide Europeans. Ms. Meloni wants to protect Italy's exports, which recorded the EU's third highest trade surplus with the U.S., at 40 billion euros, $45 billion, in 2024. Outside trade, Ms. Meloni does not always represent EU consensus. She is lukewarm on Europe's coalition of the willing for Ukraine security. Mr. Trump could also try to use Ms. Meloni to distance Europe from China after China suggested closer ties with the EU amid U.S. tariffs. How much progress can individual leaders really make? There's nothing prohibiting EU leaders from meeting individually with Mr. Trump or Mr. Vance, according to Ms. Gonzalez. Such visits can be crucial diplomatic tools. In the case of Ms. Meloni and the Trump administration, it could help restore friendly relations between the U.S. and the EU. However, bilateral talks can't be the sole basis for decisions affecting the bloc as a whole. Concerning the looming trade war, Brussels has repeatedly said that negotiating tariffs is the responsibility of the European Commission. The EU is responsible for the trade policy of member countries and negotiates agreements. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen was reportedly in close contact with Ms. Meloni ahead of her U.S. visit. The outreach has been closely coordinated, according to a commission spokesperson this week. In turn, EU leaders appear aware of the constraints. Ms. Meloni said this week in Rome that Europe was in a difficult moment and added, "I am well aware of what I represent and what I am defending." Would negotiating as a bloc help EU member states? Not necessarily. Even if decisions relating to EU trade must ultimately be made by the bloc as a whole, previous talks via traditional routes have failed to get results. This week's talks are just one example. The European Commission said afterward that it would continue to approach such talks in a constructive manner, but that significant joint efforts will be needed to achieve a successful outcome. That was a call to the U.S. administration to put more on the table, but it is also evidence of a changing landscape when it comes to negotiations, on trade or otherwise, with Mr. Trump. Former French President Valéry Giscard d'Estaing once warned of too many cooks in the kitchen in regards to the EU's ability to make deals, and the bloc has always lacked strong collective negotiation methods, says Oleg Kobzev, professor of history and international comparative politics at the American University of Paris. Mr. Trump has instead encouraged individual meetings and charm offensives, inviting close allies like Ms. Meloni to his Mar-a-Lago, Florida golf club. So what could Ms. Meloni's visits with Mr. Trump and Mr. Vance bring to Europe in the short term? Not much, says Mr. Kobzev. She could negotiate for Italy or use the visit to reassure Italians that she'll play ball with Trump, but Europe is still very powerful globally, and it's safer to be a team player for Europe. Next story. Slapped with tariffs, some U.S. trade partners lean toward Beijing. To maximize the impact of tariffs, Washington wants to ensure China cannot trade more with other countries, but Beijing is a tempting trade partner. By Ned Temko, London. So much is changing so jarringly in America's relations with China that it's easy to overlook another equally dramatic diplomatic shift that could well decide how and when their tariff war ends. It involves relations not with America's main rival power, but with its friends. For years, even during President Donald Trump's first term, U.S. strategy toward Beijing has been built on a constellation of like-minded countries making common cause against China's unfair trade practices and its growing economic, political, and military assertiveness abroad. But today, many, if not most, of those friends, alarmed by the superpower showdown, are feeling unloved, unappreciated, even scorned by the United States. The immediate reason, only days before Mr. Trump hiked tariffs on China, he had slapped tariffs on them as well. He accused them, like Beijing, of ripping off America. Though those tariffs have been put on pause as he focuses on China, the message has hit hard. "This is not the act of a friend," was the response of Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to the tariffs imposed on his and other U.S. allied countries. For Mr. Trump's tariffs to have maximum clout, Washington will want to make sure that China cannot cushion their effect by trading more with other countries. Fortunately for Washington, America's allies and trading partners have reasons of their own to be wary of a suddenly tighter embrace with Beijing. As the world's second largest economy, China already does hundreds of billions of dollars of trade with these countries. They include Australia, Japan, and South Korea in the Asia-Pacific region, as well as Britain and the 27-nation European Union. The EU, in particular, is worried that China might be tempted to engage in cut-price dumping of its exports that cannot find a market in America because tariffs make them too expensive there. But Beijing could make a case for a longer-term expansion of trade that European and Asian partners might find compelling, especially if there is no early end to the U.S.-China standoff. China could pledge not to engage in dumping or possibly even respond to a long-standing European complaint by opening up its vast domestic market. Whether that will happen, it is too early to say. Yet, since Mr. Trump's tariff announcements, China has signaled a keen awareness of the growing tension between Washington and its allies. It has sought to flip the script on perceptions of international trade, portraying itself as the guardian of stable free trade and painting Mr. Trump as a rogue and a bully. Chinese leader Xi Jinping this week visited two of the Asian countries at the top of Mr. Trump's tariff chart, Vietnam and Cambodia. Both have become increasingly important sources of American imports in the past few years. U.S. and Chinese businesses have been relocating there from China so as to avoid the risk of tariffs and tensions between the superpowers. Vietnam and Cambodia are both anxious not to jeopardize their access to the U.S. market, which now accounts for large chunks of their export-driven economies. Yet if the new tariffs on their U.S. exports are not eased by the time the three-month pause ends, they could take a major hit. Vietnam's exports to America represented 30% of its gross domestic product last year. And in a signed newspaper piece coinciding with his visit to Hanoi, Mr. Xi pointedly offered an alternative solution, declaring that China's mega market is always open to Vietnam. Chinese Premier Li Qiang and the EU's top executive Ursula von der Leyen also spoke after the U.S. tariff announcements. While the EU account of their conversation was more cautiously worded than China's, the discussions did yield a practical result, a resumption of stalled talks on the sale of cheaper Chinese electric vehicles in European countries. The EU also confirmed that a high-level delegation would be heading to Beijing in July for talks with Mr. Xi and the other senior Chinese figures. Britain also seems inclined to reset trade relations with China. That's despite a dispute this week with a Chinese company intent on shutting down the blast furnaces at a United Kingdom steelmaking plant that it owns, a move the British government intervened to halt. Business Minister Jonathan Reynolds is reportedly set to visit China in the near future and will be reviving the two countries' joint economic and trade commission. The forum has been idle for the past 6 years amid tensions over issues such as the human rights crackdown in Hong Kong. None of America's allies is about to turn away from Washington outright. Britain, which had been working with U.S. officials on a free trade agreement when Mr. Trump announced his tariffs, still hopes to get a deal done before they kick back in. The Allies' immediate concern is to insulate their economies from the effects of President Trump's tariffs. In years past, they would have expected to have been in close contact with Washington over trade policy, but times have changed. Now, when the phone rings, the call is more likely to be from Beijing. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the print disabled. And now on to the next story. Remember the opioid crisis? 46 states recorded a decline in overdose deaths. After years of epidemic, the good news on overdose deaths is both pronounced and widespread. Not only did 46 states report a decline, the total number of deaths dropped by more than 27,000 in 1 year. By Troy Aiden Sambajon and Jacob Turcott. The United States is seeing a sudden drop in overdose deaths. The country saw a 25.7 decline in drug overdose deaths in 2024 compared with the previous year, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It was the lowest number of overdose deaths in a 12-month period since 2020. Some 46 states reported a decline from 2023 to 2024. Virginia observed the most drastic reduction in deaths, a 41.6% decline. Delaware followed with a 38.4% decrease, and West Virginia reported a 36.7% decline. California, which is the largest state by population and records the most overdose cases, saw a 22.5% year-to-year decline. But public health experts are pausing before sounding any victory bells. This is a really important moment to pay attention to the trends, not to declare victory, but to increase our commitment to working together on this, says Howard Koh, a professor of public health leadership at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We need the current administration to step up and accelerate the momentum and not cut back its commitment through funding cuts and laying off public health workers at the state and federal level, says Dr. Koh. There are many concurrent factors that contributed to the drop in overdose deaths. Some prevailing theories include the increased accessibility of naloxone, which can reverse the effects of an overdose, increased access to evidence-based treatment for substance abuse disorders, and resumption of services after pandemic-related disruptions. Shifts in the illegal drug supply may also have played a role. Overall, there's more attention to public health and public safety to work together to address the crisis, says Dr. Koh, who served as a senior public health advisor during the Obama administration. We've learned we can't arrest our way out of this problem. In 2017, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services declared the opioid crisis a public health emergency. The pandemic worsened the situation, with a surge in overdose deaths due to isolation and increased fentanyl use. At its peak in 2022, nearly 108,000 people died from overdose, according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse. It is unprecedented to see predicted overdose deaths drop by more than 27,000 over a single year, said Allison Arwadi, director of CDC's National Center for Injury Prevention and Control, in a press release. That's more than 70 lives saved every day. However, public health experts like Dr. Koh remain cautious but hopeful that the downward trend continues. This is not the time to take the foot off the pedal, he says. Next story. How Donald Trump is upending American culture. President Trump's cultural agenda is reminiscent of a Stalin-esque playbook to some. Others say it's a needed correction to wokeism. Can he succeed in reshaping U.S. culture? By Linda Feldman, Washington. President Donald Trump has already made his mark, literally, on Washington's John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Days before the center was to host one of its highest profile events of the year, the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor, a marble carver added Donald J. Trump to the list of chairmen inside the center's Hall of States. To one Kennedy Center staffer, a holdover from the before times, as this person put it, the sight of President Trump's name carved onto the building was yet another reminder of the Cultural Revolution underway. So, too, were the newly hung 11-by-17-inch portraits of Mr. Trump, First Lady Melania Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, and Second Lady Usha Vance, within inches of the concert hall stage door. So every artist who passes by has to walk under Trump's glaring face, says the staffer, who asked to speak anonymously for fear of retribution. Weeks after Mr. Trump's takeover of Washington's premier cultural venue, a move aimed at countering woke influences and anti-American propaganda, he says, the shock to the district's arts world has not subsided. Many Kennedy Center performers have canceled or postponed their shows. Sales have plummeted, hurting the center's bottom line. Free tickets have been made available for some performances just to put butts in seats, as one offer of tickets to the ballet Coppelia recently put it on a neighborhood email list. It's just one of many examples of Mr. Trump's increasingly aggressive posture toward American cultural and intellectual life. In late March, Mr. Trump ordered the Smithsonian Institution's many museums, libraries, and research centers to promote American greatness. The executive order described a concerted effort by the left to rewrite history, recasting America's unparalleled legacy of advancing liberty, individual rights, and human happiness as instead racist, sexist, and oppressive, and it tapped Vice President Vance to oversee the removal of improper ideology from all Smithsonian properties. Mr. Trump also directed the Department of Interior to determine whether public monuments and other memorials have been altered since 2020 to perpetuate a false reconstruction of American history. He's targeted America's higher education as well. His threats to withhold hundreds of millions of dollars in federal research grants from major universities, in Harvard's case, $9 billion, have led to lawsuits, protests, and in some cases, capitulation by the schools. Longtime Trump watchers say they didn't necessarily expect all these particular moves, but they see a certain logic at play. Taking over the Kennedy Center seems of a piece with taking over, well, everything else, says Gwenda Blair, author of a biography on three generations of the Trump family. The cultural coup domain has flown under the radar in some ways amid all the other disruptive policy moves. Mr. Trump's special advisor, Elon Musk, is quickly dismantling, downsizing, and reorienting government agencies. The administration's aggressive deportation of immigrants has roiled the courts, and his unprecedented moves on tariffs sent financial markets into a tailspin. Big law firms that were targeted with punitive executive orders have agreed to pro bono work related to Mr. Trump's interests. But amid all the disruption and norm breaking, it's Mr. Trump's apparently keen interest in shaping American culture that may be most intriguing. To critics, it's nothing less than a sign of his authoritarian bent, reminiscent of the Stalin-esque playbook that made government diktats over artistic expression a feature of the old Soviet Union. To supporters, Mr. Trump's efforts to steer America's stories, collective history, and creative expression in a more traditional direction are a long overdue correction to wokeism. And while that conservative cultural agenda may seem minor compared with things like economic policy or immigration, its influences can be broad. In many ways, the stories America tells about its citizens and its history are fundamental to its sense of self. Mr. Trump has revived his 1776 commission, a patriotic education project from his first term, and he is clearly focused on July 4th, 2026, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. One of his first executive orders focused on planning a grand celebration worthy of the momentous occasion. A cultural phenomenon himself. The president's interest in American culture aligns with his own backstory, first as an aspiring Broadway producer and over time as a cultural phenomenon himself, be it as a New York City tabloid fixture in the 1970s and 80s, or as star of the reality TV show The Apprentice. Mr. Trump honed his knack for celebrity and ability to tap into the zeitgeist early on, ultimately taking it into politics and straight to the White House. He's had a cultural cachet and actively pursued it most of his adult life, says Henry Olson, an expert on populism at the Conservative Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington. You had Trump Airways, Trump Tower, the Trump Taj Mahal, the Trump divorces and marriages, and that's before we even get to The Apprentice. It may well be Mr. Trump's past as a TV performer and producer that best prepared him to run for and win the presidency, says Bruce Schulman, history professor at Boston University and author of The 70s, The Great Shift in American Culture, Politics, and Society. He cites a famous line from former president and Hollywood actor Ronald Reagan. How can a president not be an actor? Mr. Trump is also nearing age 80, rooted culturally in a bygone era when being on the cover of Time magazine was a big deal and the Village People were a campy and catchy new group. His campaign playlist comes straight from the 70s and 80s, with the Rolling Stones, Elton John, and ABBA in heavy rotation. Mr. Trump himself gives off a throwback vibe that, combined with appeals to masculinity, only enhances his charm to some people. That's reinforced by the celebrities around him, rapper Kid Rock, whose last song on the Billboard 100 was in 2008, recently joined the president for an Oval Office signing of an executive order on ticket scalping. He and retired 1980s wrestler Hulk Hogan were both prominently featured at the Republican National Convention last summer, and Mr. Trump's signature rally dance, which caught on in the NFL last season, sparking controversy in a realm that seeks to be apolitical, is yet more evidence of his cultural impact. Nostalgia for bygone decades goes hand in hand with an ideological cultural agenda that many conservatives have been waiting for decades to see fulfilled. To them, Mr. Trump represents their last best chance to turn back the tides of leftist messaging that they say pervades American culture, from Hollywood movies, theater, and TV, to schools, libraries, and museums. Liberal institutions like museums, like the Kennedy Center, like universities in particular, have to various degrees embraced or adopted the values of lots of liberation movements of the 1960s, from civil rights to feminism to gay rights, says Andrew Hartman, history professor at Illinois State University and author of A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. Until recently, Professor Hartman adds, conservatives haven't felt empowered to do much but complain and create their own counter-institutions, such as think tanks. Now, he says, Mr. Trump's return to office is a vindication of sorts, especially after two impeachments and multiple felony convictions, and those around him feel like he can do whatever he wants, including take over the Kennedy Center. Hamilton is out, but Les Mis goes on. The takeover of the Kennedy Center, the Capitol's cultural hub, is also likely meant to tweak the Washington elite, observers say. Notably, Mr. Trump didn't cancel its federal subsidy, as he has many other federal expenditures. Instead, he has positioned himself to make programming decisions, including potentially hosting the Kennedy Center honors, since he's the king of ratings, the president was recorded saying at his first board meeting. At the session, Mr. Trump mused about awarding posthumous awards to Luciano Pavarotti, Elvis Presley, and Babe Ruth. He also gave a thumbs up to the musical Les Miserables, which will come to the Kennedy Center this summer, and he criticized Hamilton, whose planned 2026 run was canceled by creator Lin-Manuel Miranda after the Trump takeover. The president's new role hasn't resulted in all MAGA all the time programming. The Mark Twain Prize ceremony honoring comedian Conan O'Brien went on as scheduled, including a supporting cast of sharp-tongued A-list comics. The show will air May 4th on Netflix. The free offerings at the Kennedy Center's Millennium Stage also continue to feature shows that might appeal to a more liberal crowd. Racially diverse spoken word artists, a Cuban rapper, a singer who combines traditional jazz scat with native vocables. Singer Eileen Jewell, long ago scheduled to perform at the Millennium Stage on April 10th, justified her decision to proceed in a recent Facebook post. "I do for the Kennedy Center the same as I do for my country," Ms. Jewell wrote. "I stay and fight for the good that's left in it." Still, the Kennedy Center employee who spoke to the monitor depicts an atmosphere of fear mixed with determination among remaining staff after senior leaders were fired and replaced with Trump loyalists. Rick Grinnell, who has fulfilled many roles in both Trump terms and is currently the center's interim director, is on site more now than he was initially, the staffer says, but he has yet to have an all-staff meeting or formally introduce himself to the staff. Key members of Mr. Grinnell's team appear to have no experience in the arts, nonprofits, or philanthropy, the source adds. One item on the new team's agenda, figuring out how to have Mr. Trump on site without getting booed. Mr. Vance and his wife were booed last month at a National Symphony Orchestra concert. The new front office has floated MAGA-only nights, also patron advisories, the anonymous staffer writes in a text. The Kennedy Center and White House did not respond to requests for comment, but the staffer makes clear that they and their colleagues aren't giving up without a fight. A lot of us, on a day-to-day basis, the source says, pick ourselves up and re-enter this building with the spirit of preserving the mission, doing what we can to not abandon the ship. And finally, the commentary from the Monitor's editorial board. The Art of Emancipation in Paris. An exhibit at the Center Pompidou displays the creativity of black artists from Africa, the Caribbean, and the United States who flocked to the French capital after 1945 for mental liberation from stereotypes. When a special exhibit opened in Paris at the Pompidou Center on March 19th, the visitors' line was particularly long. The City of Light, it seems, is eager for an illuminating peek into its recent past as a creative haven for black people from either side of the Atlantic after World War II. The museum had put together a show called Paris Noir. It is a collection of more than 300 works by a diaspora of talent, 150 Africans, Afro-Caribbean Islanders, and African-Americans. These creators were drawn to the French capital in the second half of the 20th century, a time when the city's vibrant culture of art, literature, and music was inextricably intertwined with intense political debate and a growing social consciousness. Many of them were from countries recently emerged or still emerging from European colonization. Many were also descendants of enslaved people. In Paris, they found a mental liberation from social and racial stereotypes or political repression in their homelands, spanning half a century of creativity. From sculpture to magazines to poetry, the works in the exhibit are a reflection of the times, of the explosion of civil rights victories in the United States, and of hard-fought independence from the West Indies to West Africa and beyond. Many of the works were not taken seriously at the time. The exhibit, which lasts until June 30th, is an overdue recognition of the artist's contribution to Paris. It is also a reminder of freedom's role in liberating individual expression and art's role in the struggle for that very freedom and for equality. While the art on display is a face to the past, the show is also a step into the future. A future of visibility and recognition. Many countries now recognize the contributions of formerly marginalized people as integral to their national lore and history. The effect of such regard can be restorative, a way to move societies forward and to show the power of creativity in breaking mental barriers. That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, April 17th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for listening. Good night.